succeeded magnificently. She keyed her wristcom. "Patrick," she said, "the Starcom is down. Do you still want to go to the surface?"
"Yes, Captain," Davidson said. "Someone has to warn General Eastside."
Kat nodded impatiently. The Admiral still hadn't responded to her call.
"Then good luck," she said.
Was the Admiral occupied, or was something more sinister going on?
"Watch your back."
The terminal bleeped, informing her that the Admiral had finally responded. Kat braced herself, then keyed the switch. Morrison's face appeared in front of her, looking tired and worn. Had they just woken him up? She checked local time and fought down the temptation to swear out loud. It was local night, just past midnight. She'd forgotten that detail in her desperate rush to return to Cadiz.
"Captain," the Admiral said.
He didn't sound happy.
"I was at a party. My daughter is being introduced to Lord Percy. What is the meaning of this?"
"The system is about to be attacked," Kat said flatly.
She tapped a switch, transmitting the records her ship had collected. Her tactical department's analysts had been working their way through them, but hadn't drawn any useful conclusions yet.
"The Theocracy has an attack fleet within range, which may be less than an hour from Cadiz."
She glanced at a message that blinked up on her display. The vast majority of the fleet's commanding officers were down on the surface, either at the spaceport or enjoying themselves at the Admiral's estate. Kat had to fight to keep her face impassive. Had they learned nothing from the previous attack? The Starcom was down, the victim of sabotage, and yet they were partying? She clenched her jaw. The theory about the Admiral being in the Theocracy's pay was starting to seem a great deal more plausible.
"Your ship provoked them, Captain," the Admiral said.
Kat said a word she knew her mother would have slapped her for saying, at least in front of her social inferiors. But it caught the Admiral's attention.
"Admiral," she said, "it doesn't matter if they thought they were provoked or not. They have already started their campaign. The loss of the Starcom cannot be coincidence. Their attack fleet is already advancing towards Cadiz. I implore you, Admiral, to sound the alert and ready 7th Fleet for action. Time is running out."
"Captain," the Admiral said, "I..."
His image vanished from the display. Kat stared, then reached for her wristcom. It bleeped before she could touch it, just as alerts flashed up through her implants. The entire planetary command and control network had just crashed violently. Each and every starship, orbital defense platform, and automated tracking system was now isolated from everyone else.
"Captain," the XO said, "the spaceport is under attack. So is Government House."
"Red alert," Kat ordered. Davidson, where is he?"
"His shuttle was heading towards the spaceport," the XO said.
"Recall him," Kat snapped.
Newer alerts were flashing up as the command and control system struggled to rebuild itself. The spaceport wasn't the only place under attack. It looked as though insurgents were striking everywhere, from forward operating bases to medical centers and even economic assistance facilities. There were so many attacks that the garrison commander would be unable to decide which one was the key, which one to deal with first.
"We need him back on board."
She took a breath.
"And try to re-establish a link to the Admiral."
"That might be impossible," Roach said.
The tactical officer sounded worried.
"Government House is under heavy attack."
Kat shuddered. How many locals, from street sweepers to prostitutes, had worked within the security fence? They'd had years to plan their uprising, smuggling weapons into the complex while pretending to be good little collaborators. And now they were throwing everything they had at their hated oppressors. The Admiral might already be dead. He was certainly in no position to take command of the fleet.
"We can't even call in orbital strikes," the XO warned. "There's no way to separate our forces from enemy insurgents."
"Recall Davidson," Kat repeated.
At least she had a full crew on her ship. God alone knew how many of the other ships had full complements.
"And then try to establish links to the remainder of 7th Fleet."
She looked down at her hands, unsure of what to do. The entire situation was unraveling.
and the enemy fleet hadn't even put in an appearance.
Given time and orbital control, the Commonwealth could restore some semblance of order, but she knew the Theocracy would know it too. Their fleet would have to arrive soon.
Unless they want us to slaughter the insurgents, she thought morbidly. They're not going to leave Cadiz alone either. Better to kill off everyone who might resist first.
Captain, Ross said, I have lost contact with the Marine shuttles.
Cat shivered. I'm on my way, she said. She rose. Keep trying to re-establish contact. The high-velocity missile came out of nowhere. Davidson and his men had no time to do more than brace themselves before the missile slammed into the shuttle's drive field, sending them tumbling down towards the ground. The pilot struggled to maintain control, somehow managing to keep the craft steady long enough to make a proper crash landing. Davidson rose to his feet as soon as the craft was down, then ran for the hatch. Outside it was calm, suspiciously calm. But in the distance, he could see smoke rising from the direction of the spaceport.
I can't make contact with anyone, Corporal Loomis reported as the Marines fanned out weapons at the ready.
Everyone was accounted for, but whoever had shot them down might be coming to finish the job.
The planetary data net is down.
Davidson swallowed a curse. They'd landed in rough country, several miles from the spaceport, Gibraltar, or the PDC. If the smoke was any indicator, the spaceport was under attack, and he couldn't see any signs of shuttles coming or going over the land. And that suggested the insurgents had the spaceport locked down. For once he found himself unsure of what to do. What were their orders if caught in hostile territory?
Any other world would have a large population willing to help us, he thought. But not here.
We need to move away from the spaceport, he said finally. He wanted to run towards the installation and join the defenders, but the battle might well be over by the time the Marines arrived. He'd seen too much of the spaceport's interior to have any illusions about how long it could defend itself if it came under heavy attack. There were just too many enemies within the walls.
And find somewhere to go to ground. None of his troops argued. Instead, they followed him as he led the way towards the capital city. Strangers would be noticed in the countryside, he suspected. It would be better to blend in with city dwellers as much as possible, and they would probably have to ditch their uniforms and most of their weapons at some point. He cursed the Admiral under his breath. It would have been relatively simple to ensure the shit never hit the fan, or at least that the installations on the surface were secure. But Morrison had been too lazy, or criminally negligent, to care. Davidson silently promised himself that the Admiral would not survive, no matter what else happened. He wouldn't be allowed to go home and plead his case. Shaking his head, he looked towards the smoke rising from the city. It was unlikely Admiral Morrison was still alive.
I have a live feed from a drone near the spaceport, Ross reported. The installation is under heavy attack.
Cat nodded as the images appeared on the display. The entire complex seemed devastated. Fires were burning everywhere, while a number of destroyed shuttles lay on the ground. She could see hundreds of dead bodies while a handful of men armed with makeshift weapons prowled the complex, seeking survivors. The barracks, which should have housed over 2,000 soldiers, were nothing more than debris. It was clear that the defenders had been overwhelmed before they'd even known they were under attack. She bit her lip.
Do we have a link to Government House or the PDC?
General Eastside seems to have taken command of the PDC, Ross said. But there's no contact with Government House.
Cat nodded, unsurprised. The Admiral was dead. Most of the senior naval officers were dead, or, she told herself, they were out of contact. Not that it really mattered, she suspected. The spaceport was flaming debris, while insurgents prowled the countryside with surface-to-air missiles. There was no way she could send shuttles to recover the commanding officers, even if she'd had a solid lock on their positions. They'd be shot down by the insurgents.
Purge the communications system completely, she ordered.
It would destroy any encryption codes, but right now they were worse than useless. Kat and her crew would have to send in the clear and hope the enemy wasn't able to intercept and read messages in time to make a difference.
And try to re-establish the data net for Seventh Fleet.
And then new alarms sounded, followed by red lights on the display. Commander Fran Higgins had never considered herself prone to despair. As a Mustang, she had known her promotion prospects were limited compared to officers who had followed the proper command track. But she had also believed her competence would see her through. But Cadiz had sapped her determination even before the shit had finally hit the fan. If she hadn't had the bare bones of a plan, and taken steps to prepare Defiant for operations, she might well have given up completely. She sat on the bridge, in the captain's chair, trying to pull some sense out of the distorted reports from the planet's surface. Some of them were obvious nonsense, others far too optimistic to be believed easily. But she knew the worst when she finally saw the live feed from the spaceport. The occupation was doomed. "The captain is dead," she said flatly. A third of the crew was still down on the surface, if they weren't dead themselves, but at least she'd managed to keep the more competent officers and crew on the ship.
"I want full operational power as soon as possible."
"We're working on it,"
Chief Engineer Ryan said. Thank God he was competent. There were at least two engineers attached to the fleet who had to have politically powerful relatives, or they would never have been promoted.
"But it will take at least 10 minutes to bring the ship to full power."
Fran cursed loudly enough to shock several of the younger officers.
"Keep working on it," she snapped.
There was nothing else she could do.
"And..."
New icons flared into life on the display.
"Vortexes!"
Lieutenant Robbins shouted. She sounded as though she was on the verge of panic.
"Multiple vortexes!" "Divert all power to weapons, shields, and drives,"
Fran ordered. The enemy fleet had arrived, and the mighty Super Dreadnought and the rest of her squadron were practically sitting ducks. They could do without life support long enough to escape, or they'd be dead anyway.
"And stand by point defense!"
She gritted her teeth. The enemy ships were already launching gunboats, and Seventh Fleet's gunboat crews were in disarray. It was unlikely many of them could launch in time to make a difference. The fleet was thoroughly screwed. And there was still no word from the Admiral. Chapter 31
"Report,"
Admiral Junaid ordered.
"The infidel fleet is in disarray," the sensor officer reported. "They're trying to power up their drives and weapons, but they're at a very low state of readiness."
"God is with us,"
the cleric said. Admiral Junaid ignored him.
"Launch gunboats,"
he ordered. The infidels could not be allowed more time to prepare. One icon sparkled on the display and he glowered at it. The spying battlecruiser had made it back to Cadiz, too late. They'd already lost the Starcom, ensuring they couldn't send an alert to the remainder of the Commonwealth.
"Targets are the capital ships. They are not to leave this system alive."
He paused significantly.
"The battle line will advance," he added. "The troop ships and their escorts will remain behind, ready to escape back into hyperspace if necessary."
The cleric turned to face him.
"Admiral,"
he said,
"must I remind you of the importance of bringing Cadiz into the fold?"
"We cannot land troops until we have defeated the enemy fleet," Junaid pointed out. It was important to establish a strong presence on Cadiz, if only to hunt down the surviving Commonwealth personnel, but he was keen to keep the Janissaries and the Inquisitors away from Cadiz as long as possible. A few days under their rule, and the locals would start rebelling again.
"And besides, I don't care to offer the enemy a clear shot at annihilating the troops before they hit the ground."
He settled back, contemplating the task before him. His super dreadnoughts would finish the job of blowing their way through the Commonwealth's defenses and obliterating their fleet. The balance of power would swing decisively in the theocracy's favor within an hour. "And transmit the formal summons to surrender," he added. "We must invite them to submit to us." It would be good if they did surrender, he knew, even though he would be cheated of a battle. But he wasn't expecting a surrender. The Commonwealth was no isolated single-star system, unable to police space outside its atmosphere. They had space they could trade for time and powerful fleets in reserve. It was possible they would despair so completely they wouldn't realize they could fall back, but he wasn't counting on it. They had had too much time to think since their spy ship had returned home. "And send a general signal to the fleet," he concluded. "Today we fight for victory." Cat watched as countless vortexes opened and dispersed nemesis. 27 super dreadnoughts, 42 smaller craft, and over 500 gunboats, launching now from their carriers. The tiny vessels carried one hell of a sting, she knew, and a handful of them could take down a super dreadnought. The gunboat pilots of the 7th Fleet were still dawdling. It would be too late by the time they joined the fray.
"Picking up a message," Ross said. "They're beaming it all over the system."
"Put it through," Cat ordered. The voice was strongly accented, although Cat couldn't place it.
"Infidels, the hour of judgment is at hand," he said. "Accept your fate, surrender your ships, and join us in worship of the one true God, or die at our hands and be plunged into the bitterest hell. You have 10 minutes to comply."
Cat glanced at the display. 10 minutes. Just long enough for the super dreadnoughts to enter firing range. The gunboats would be on the fleet in 2 minutes, unless the fleet surrendered beforehand. But that was not going to happen. The officers who might have surrendered had died on Cadiz.
"Outsmarted yourself, didn't you?" she thought with a moment of bitter amusement. "Your plan worked too well."
But she knew it was unlikely to matter. She looked at the XO. "Do we have any ID on the senior surviving officer?"
"I can't find anyone higher than a commander," the XO said.
He sounded shocked. It was easy to believe now that Admiral Morrison had been an enemy agent all along.
"The fleet is completely headless."
Cat drew in a breath. "Open a channel to the entire fleet," she ordered. She waited for Ross's nod, then continued. "This is Captain Cat Falcone. I am taking command of the fleet." She pressed on before anyone could challenge her. Technically, she outranked everyone else confirmed to be alive, but they would know how little experience she had. And she wasn't part of 7th Fleet's command network. Someone might well challenge her on those grounds alone. But, not entirely to her surprise, no one raised a challenge. They were all too focused on staying alive. "Route the tactical fleet command net through Lightning," she ordered, cursing the designers under her breath. Lightning just wasn't designed for fleet command. If the designers hadn't been so fixated on winning the contracts for a whole new generation of command-capable heavy cruisers... She shook her head bitterly. It was water under the bridge now. "And get me a full status update." She took a breath. At least some of the gunboats were finally getting out into open space. It was clear the pilots were disoriented and their flight rosters had been shot to hell, but they were out in space. She issued orders to the gunboats to engage the enemy gunboats before they attacked the fleet, then weighed the situation as best as she could. No matter how she played it in her mind, she saw nothing but defeat if they held their position and tried to fight. The enemy fleet had them firmly under their guns. None of the reports sounded promising either. Her best super dreadnoughts required at least 2 weeks in the yards before they could be considered combat capable, even though the crews were doing their best to bring the ships to battle stations. Many of the smaller ships were in better condition, the rot hadn't set in so badly, but they didn't have the firepower to take on the theocracy.
"We will cover the super dreadnoughts until they are ready to escape," she ordered.
The theocracy would go for the super dreadnoughts first, just to take them out before they could be brought back to full readiness. It would be quicker to repair any ships that escaped than build new hulls from scratch.
"And as soon as they are ready to go, we will beat a hasty retreat."
She felt several of her officers glancing at her back in disbelief. The Royal Navy didn't run. But the Royal Navy had never faced a serious challenge before. They had never been involved in the Breakaway Wars, The only real opponent had been pirates, and none of them had posed more than a brief challenge to their might. And if Seventh Fleet had been worked up and ready to go, they might have given the Theocracy a bloody nose. But she knew all they could do was run. "The Board of Inquiry might blame me for running," she thought, as the enemy gunboats raced closer. "But they won't blame anyone else."
"The planetary defense network is still crippled," the Exo said. "But some of the automated platforms have been isolated from the communications net and are responding to orders."
"Target them on the gunboats," Kat ordered. She braced herself. "And stand by point defense." She watched grimly as the gunboats slashed into engagement range, evading with consummate skill as the super dreadnoughts opened fire with point defense. No gunboat could stand up to a single blast, but they were incredibly hard to hit. She had to admire the professionalism shown by the enemy pilots as they closed in on their targets, then opened fire with ship-killer missiles. Armed with antimatter, they would be devastating against shielded and unshielded targets alike.
"Antimatter detonations," Roche reported, as four of the missiles were picked off by point defense. "They're not holding back, Captain."
Kat nodded. The gunboats had scored five direct hits on one super dreadnought, blowing the massive vessel out of formation. For a long moment, it looked as though Hammer of Thor had survived. Then the starship vanished inside a massive fireball. Kat fought down despair as the gunboats raced away from the destroyed ship, then reformed and angled back towards their next target. The point defense crews continued firing, trying to pick off the gunboats before they could enter engagement range again. But it seemed a waste of effort.
"Message to Super Dreadnoughts," Kat ordered.
Safety regulations warned against it, but she was so far past caring that it hardly mattered.
"They are to launch ship killers on dispersal mode."
"Aye, Captain," the Exo said.
He seemed to have fallen into the role of her operations officer, even though he should have taken command of the cruiser while she commanded the entire fleet. But there was no time to switch roles.
"But that will damage our data net."
Kat shrugged.
"What data net?" "Direct hit starboard hull," the tactical officer snapped. "Shields held, but barely."
Fran nodded. Defiant had been lucky. Four of the gunboats assigned to her had been picked off before they could launch their missiles, detonating the antimatter in their warheads and wiping out several of their comrades. Only one missile had struck her shields. Fran was grimly aware that the starship's shields were held together by spit and baling wire. She glanced at the order from Lightning, then smiled.
"Launch ship killers on dispersal mode," she ordered. "Target clumps of enemy ships and fire!"
She smirked as the super dreadnought launched a spread of antimatter-armed missiles aimed at the gunboat formation. There was no hope of actually scoring a hit, but it didn't matter. The warheads detonated as soon as they were within range, the giant explosions wiping out dozens of gunboats and disabling several others. It wasn't a viable tactic in the long run, but it would buy them some time. But would it be enough?
7 minutes until we can open a vortex, the engineer reported.
Fran cursed. It was going to be a long 7 minutes.
"Clever," Admiral Junaid observed.
His gunboats had been hammered by the ship killers, far too many of them swatted out of space like flies. The remainder would have to return to their carriers to rearm before they could return to the fight.
"But futile."
He smiled grimly as the fleet finally came into range.
"Target missiles on the super dreadnoughts," he ordered, "and open fire."
Moments later, the Theocracy's super dreadnoughts launched the first full broadside of the war.
"The enemy's super dreadnoughts have opened fire," Roach reported.
Kat nodded, unsurprised. Under normal circumstances, firing at extreme range would have been futile. There would have been plenty of time for a fleet command data net to lock onto the missiles, calculate interception trajectories, and open fire. Hell, the missiles might have burned out their drives and gone ballistic by the time they entered the point defense envelope, making their destruction a certainty. But this time the tactic might well pay off for the Theocrats. "The point defense data net barely exists," she thought, "and the bastards are practically holding the planet hostage.
one antimatter missile on the surface and most of the population will die.
She gritted her teeth. The super dreadnoughts are to fall back, if they can muster the power, she ordered. She hated to do it, but preserving the fleet was her first priority. Cadiz would just have to take care of itself.
Reform the fleet. I want smaller ships between the super dreadnoughts and the incoming missiles. If we can't form a data net, I want to put out enough firepower to prevent the missiles from getting through.
Aye, Captain, the Exo said. And the planet?
Cat cursed herself under her breath. She couldn't leave Cadiz completely undefended.
Reprogram the planetary defenses, she ordered. They would normally have put the planet first, but the standard command network was in tatters. They are to concentrate on missiles that might enter the planet's atmosphere.
Aye, Captain, the Exo said.
He sounded relieved.
The enemy fleet is picking up speed.
Order our super dreadnoughts to fire a return barrage, Cat ordered. The Theocracy's fleet was advancing towards her ships, shortening the effective engagement range. But there would be no coordinated fire. She would just have to hope her fire dissuaded the enemy from pursuing too closely. And then angle the point defense to provide as much cover as possible. She watched grimly as the swarm of missiles rocketed towards the fleet. None of them were targeted on lightning. Thankfully, the limited data net had prevented the Theocracy from realizing that a mere heavy cruiser was the linchpin of the fleet. But there were more than enough of them to do real damage. Her ship's point defense went to work, sweeping missiles out of space. Yet there seemed to be no shortage racing towards her super dreadnoughts. Then they started to strike home. Kali is gone, Roach reported. Agent Court and Bosworth have taken heavy damage. Bosworth reports that her drive section is completely gone. Butcher and Thundercracker have both taken limited damage.
Cat nodded.
Keep trying to link our point defense together, she ordered.
If Bosworth had lost her drives, there was no way she could be saved.
Order Bosworth to transfer all non-essential crew to her shuttles.
A green icon flickered once, then vanished, to be replaced by a handful of icons representing life pods.
King David is gone, Roach said bleakly. Defiant is requesting permission to launch SAR shuttles.
Cat hesitated.
Denied, she said, finally.
The enemy gunboats would fire on shuttles, even though they were performing search and rescue duties.
The life pods are to make their way to the planet.
Roach turned to stare at her.
Captain. That's an order, mister, Cat snapped. Concentrate on your duties.
She understood his feelings all too well. The Royal Navy didn't leave anyone behind. It had been hammered into them at Piker's Peak that starship crewmen and officers had to depend on one another. But she didn't dare risk allowing SAR shuttles to be engaged by enemy gunboats, or, for that matter, leaving them behind. One more thing for the Board of Inquiry to judge, she thought. After they've buried Morrison, perhaps they'll bury me. The thought was a bitter one. She hadn't been expected to assume command of the fleet. In hindsight, perhaps she should have made contingency plans to do just that. But she had never believed the disaster could be on so great a scale. It was a failure of imagination that would cost the Commonwealth dearly. If the Admiralty wanted a scapegoat, and Admiral Morrison was safely dead, they might turn their gaze on her. Lightning shuddered violently.
One of the missiles engaged us, Roach snapped. No major damage.
Cat exchanged glances with the XO.
Pull us back, she ordered.
She glanced at the display, wondering if the enemy had worked out that Lightning was the command ship. But if they had, they would have thrown everything at her.
Time to escape?
4 super dreadnoughts are reporting that they've lost their drive sections,
the XO said.
The remainder will be ready to open vortexes in 2 minutes.
Cat felt very cold, very composed. The starships that cannot escape are to move forward and shield their fellows, she ordered, hating herself. The remainder are to keep falling back. There was no choice. She knew there was no choice. With so many weapons being fired in the same region of space, it would be impossible for one starship to open a vortex for the stragglers. and yet it smacked of sacrificing others to save herself.
"Aye, Captain," the Exo said.
The fighting seemed to grow more intense as the enemy ships concentrated their fire on the lead super-dreadnoughts. Their commanders switched all remaining power to shields and weapons, then fought savagely, trying to hold the line. For a long moment, Kat dared hope that they would manage to hold the line. But she knew it wouldn't happen. The Theocracy was already targeting those ships specifically.
"Captain," the Exo said, "the super-dreadnoughts are reporting that they're ready to jump."
Kat hesitated. Davidson was on Cadiz, along with thousands of Commonwealth personnel, all of whom would be at the mercy of either the Theocrats or the local insurgents. She had no idea how the Theocrats would treat their prisoners, but she suspected it wouldn't be in line with any of the post-UN conventions. She didn't want to abandon them, yet she knew all she could do was die in their defense, perhaps costing the Commonwealth its chance to win the war. They had to retreat. "Open the vortexes," she ordered. There was no longer any time to delay.
"Take us out of here." "Admiral," the sensor officer snapped, "the infidel fleet is retreating."
Junaid cursed under his breath. Four super-dreadnoughts seemed determined to fight to the last, but the remainder were falling back and opening vortexes, escaping into hyperspace. He knew he couldn't give chase, not now. An engagement in hyperspace could easily go either way.
"Let them go," he ordered.
There were still the few remaining super-dreadnoughts in real space, fighting desperately. As he watched, one of them lost a shield and immediately rotated to avoid exposing the chink in its defenses to incoming fire.
"Retarget missiles on the remaining ships."
He watched, feeling an odd glow of admiration, as the four super-dreadnoughts fought and died. They couldn't stop him. They had to know they couldn't stop him. But they fought desperately to win their fellows time. In the end, they died, but they died bravely. It sent shivers down his spine. They'd calculated the infidels would be weak, that they would not put up a fight. And they'd been wrong. It was easy to imagine now that the war would be far from victorious.
"They might have staved off defeat," he thought. "And who knows what that will cost us in time."
But he couldn't say it out loud. Who knew who might be listening?
"Clear the planet's skies," he ordered.
The remaining platforms were fighting desperately, but there could only be one outcome. It was the PDC that would pose a more significant problem.
"And then prepare the landing force."
Chapter 32.
"I think that was the fleet leaving," Corporal Loomis said.
"We're on our own."
Davidson nodded, looking up to see flashes of light in the sky and pieces of debris falling through the atmosphere. No one had come hunting for them, as far as they could tell. Perhaps the insurgents had assumed the Marines had died in the crash. But the area was about to get very dangerous. The PDC would be able to engage anything it saw landing, yet that wouldn't be enough to stop the Theocracy. They'd simply land their troops outside the PDC's range and advance toward Gibraltar. He consulted the planetary map he'd downloaded into his implants. There were a number of small farms nearby, largely ignored by both sides of the war. They might make a good place to hide. The alternative, heading further into the undeveloped regions of the planet, would take them out of the war completely. He considered it briefly, remembered his oath to the Royal Marines, and then made up his mind.
"We head towards the farms," he said. "If we can find a place to hide there, we'll hole up and wait to see what happens."
More flashes of light filled the sky as the Theocracy closed in on the undefended world. It wouldn't be long before they started landing troops, Davidson told himself, or scrutinizing orbital imagery for any sign of stragglers. He and his team needed to get undercover long before that happened, or at the very least abandon their uniforms. The Marines kept moving, slipping into a forest in the hopes it would provide at least some cover as a series of thunderous explosions sounded in the distance. Davidson turned in time to see a fireball rising up from the east.
It suggested the enemy fleet was softening up the planet by bombarding known Commonwealth positions from orbit.
I'm picking up a message, Loomis said. It's on the emergency frequency.
Davidson opened his implants and accepted the message.
Is east side, a voice said.
It was so racked with static that it was impossible to be sure, even with his implants, that it actually was General Eastside.
The theocracy is landing troops. If you can disengage and hide, do so. The Navy will—
The message faded as the theocracy jammers went to work. Davidson scanned the airwaves through his implants, hoping the signal would be repeated, but there was nothing. The enemy had control of the high orbitals now, and they intended to use them. Flashes of light burst out from the direction of the PDC, weapons being dropped to test the base's force field. It was clear the PDC was holding out, but not for long. The base might be able to stand off projectiles from orbit, yet it couldn't defend itself against ground troops indefinitely.
"We keep moving," he grunted. "And pray we find a way to strike back at the bastards."
It was nearly 40 minutes before they came across their first farm. Davidson surveyed it from a distance, looking for signs of life, but saw nothing. The complex was really nothing more than a handful of small fields with some sheep, cows, and chickens, large enough to be productive, yet small enough to be operated by a single family. He felt a sudden sense of wistfulness for the farm he'd left behind, then started to walk down towards the barn. His men followed him at a distance. There was no sign of anyone in the barn, but his experienced eyes could see signs that the farm had been tended recently, which suggested the owners were hiding. He motioned the Marines forward, then slipped up to the farmhouse. It was a wooden structure, like many early colonial buildings, but someone had added brick and stone outhouses to give the family more living space. Davidson was more impressed than he cared to admit, but froze as he heard someone talking inside. The voice was local, and sounded fearful. He hesitated. If they asked for help, they might be betrayed. And if they took what they needed, they would be betrayed. The only safe options were to back away from the farm or kill the inhabitants. But he was damned if he was slaughtering innocent people whose only crime was being a potential liability.
"And what will you do?" a nasty little voice said at the back of his mind. "When the theocracy is torturing your team because you were too nice to the locals."
He motioned for Loomis and Private Jackson to cover him, then opened the door and stepped inside. A family. A surprisingly large family. Looked up from their table and stared at him, their eyes wide with horror and fear. Like most of the locals, they had dark skin and darker eyes, but their clothes suggested a prosperity most of their compatriots didn't share. The oldest man stared, then moved to protect his 5 daughters. His 3 sons looked as though they wanted to hurl themselves at the Marines, but didn't quite dare. Davidson found his voice.
"We're looking for a place to hide," he said.
He hoped the locals understood galactic standard. Cadiz certainly should have included it as a second language, but he could understand why they might have resisted its introduction.
"We mean you no harm."
The farmer stumbled to his feet. Davidson read his expression and felt a moment of pity. The man was scared, caught between multiple fires, just like everyone else trapped in the middle of the war. If he tried to send Davidson away, the Marines might turn on him. If he helped, he might be branded a collaborator and killed by his own people. Or the theocracy.
"You can't stay here," he stammered, finally. "You'll be seen."
"We can hide," Davidson said, as reassuringly as he could.
"And we won't cause you any trouble."
He paused, then took a gamble.
"And we also need to talk to the local fighters," he added. "Can you introduce us to them?"
The farmer stared at him in shock. Davidson understood all too well. At one point, admitting any connection with the insurgents would have been a death sentence. But now? Making contact with the insurgents was a gamble, but it was one he knew they had to take. And besides, it might give their unwilling host some limited protection. The insurgents would know he'd done the best he could.
You can wait in the barn, the farmer said after a moment. I'll have food brought to you.
The farmer's wife eyed Davidson unpleasantly. She didn't seem any happier than her husband about having the Marines anywhere near her daughters, but stood and started to gather a batch of fruit and vegetables. Davidson nodded, then slipped out of the door and led the way back to the barn. In the distance, the sound of explosions was growing louder, carried on the still air. The theocracy was definitely landing troops. He sat down in the barn and started to check his weapons, motioning for the other Marines to do the same. If the insurgents attacked or called the theocracy, they would have no choice but to fight to the death. There were just too many horror stories of what happened to prisoners who fell into theocratic hands. He was damned if he was allowing them to take him alive.
I'm picking up a general broadcast, Loomis said suddenly.
It's on all frequencies.
Let me hear, Davidson said.
It's repeating, Loomis said.
Hang on.
This planet is now under the jurisdiction of the theocracy, a stern voice said. Troops are landing and will occupy strategic points of importance as soon as possible. Civilians are warned to stay off the streets. Do not carry weapons anywhere near theocratic soldiers or you will be shot or detained. Commonwealth military personnel are ordered to make themselves known to theocratic authorities as soon as they arrive. Monitor radio broadcasts for further orders.
Well, Jackson said. They're not mincing words, are they?
Here comes the new boss, same as the old boss, Corporal Marcia agreed.
Sir?
Davidson looked up sharply. The farmer and two of his sons were standing in the doorway, carrying trays of food. Davidson rose to his feet, took one of the trays, and thanked the men profusely. The farmer looked irked but grateful that he hadn't been shot. He motioned for Davidson to follow him outside.
I have sent my daughter to speak to the freedom fighters, he said. You may have a visitor.
Let us hope so, Davidson said with the private thought that one visitor wouldn't be a problem. A whole army of visitors would be a major threat.
Have you heard the broadcast?
It's on all channels, the farmer said. His expression twisted.
Your people did the same when you took our planet.
Patrick lowered his eyes, ashamed.
Wait, the farmer said. See what the fighters have to say.
The food was tasty enough, Davidson supposed, as the Marines ate and then tried to catch up on their sleep. He spent the time listening for other broadcasts, trying to identify snippets of conversation that made it through the omnipresent jamming and create a working picture of just what was actually going on. But it was impossible to draw more than a very rough idea, based on the location of enemy transmitters. It looked as though the occupation force was taking up positions around Gibraltar before moving on to the city itself.
Reasonable, he thought sourly. They'd want to try to make sure they cut all lines of supply and that no one could escape before they entered the city and secured it for themselves.
He sighed, wondering just what had happened to Cat and her ships. None of her plans had expected the shit to hit the fan this badly, not as far as he knew. Had she made it out, he wondered, or had lightning been destroyed in the battle? Were the pieces of debris falling from the sky the last remains of Cat and her ship? He shook his head firmly. Cat had an intact ship and crew. She would have made it out. But who knew where she was now?
Taking out the Starcom was brilliant, he thought. It makes it impossible for us to coordinate our forces. Cat and the survivors wouldn't even know where to go.
We've got contact, Loomis snapped. Two people making their way towards the barn. I can't see any weapons. Davidson leaned forward. That's the farmer's daughter, he said. He'd seen the girl when he'd entered the farmhouse. She was pretty enough, and she was almost as muscular as a female Marine. But then a farm was no place for a shrinking violet or a weakling.
And the person she's with.
He stared. There was something odd about the person. Something that sent alarm bells jangling at the back of his mind. He wore jeans and a shirt and a large hat that obscured his face, yet something wasn't quite right. But there was no time to think about it. Motioning for the Marines to stay back, Davidson walked out of the barn and down towards the two newcomers. The farmer's daughter muttered something, then turned and walked back to the farmhouse, leaving the stranger alone.
"Greetings," the stranger said. "You seem to be a little lost."
Davidson blinked in sudden understanding. The stranger wasn't a man, but a woman. No, a girl who looked round 19, wearing men's clothes and doing her best to pass as a man. From what he recalled of local culture, that was unlikely to please anyone, although it hardly mattered in the Commonwealth, where men and women held interchangeable roles. Cadiz was nowhere near as restrictive when it came to women as the theocracy, but a woman playing at being a man would have shocked the locals. But it was quite possible none of them had noticed. They would be too accustomed to thinking man when they saw someone in male clothing.
"I suppose you could put it that way," he said.
He sat down on the grass, trying to seem as non-threatening as possible. It wasn't easy.
"And yourself?"
"Uncertain," the girl admitted. She sat, then held out a calloused hand. "My name is Jess, by the way." Patrick nodded. Jess, as a name, could be either male or female, which made sense. Had her father wanted a boy? Or had she merely called herself by a name that could apply to both sexes and allowed everyone to draw the wrong conclusion? There was no way to know without asking her, yet it wasn't something he dared ask. If she'd hidden her sex from her fellow fighters, she wouldn't take kindly to having her secret in the hands of an outsider. "Patrick," he said, taking her hand and shaking it firmly. She definitely had a very masculine handshake.
"Royal Marines."
"I'll get right to the point," Jess said.
"What are you doing here?"
"Our shuttle was shot down," Davidson said. "We hiked here while the attack began. Now, we're hiding."
"An interesting role reversal for you," Jess said.
She met his eyes. "Is there a reason I shouldn't call the theocracy and hand you over to them?" Davidson hesitated, composing his arguments.
"I assume you've heard their broadcast," he said. "They're not here to liberate you from our clutches. They're here to take your world for themselves."
"I heard their broadcast," Jess said.
"I've heard hundreds of accounts from refugees," Davidson continued. "They will reshape your society to suit themselves. The best you can hope for is that you will be treated as second-class citizens on your own homeworld, your religions shattered, and your population forced to follow their rules. At worst, you will simply be marginalized and scattered."
Jess lifted her eyebrows. "And this will be different from your occupation?"
"Oh yes," Davidson said. "It will be far worse. And permanent."
He took a breath.
"Men of power and influence will be killed," he said. "People like yourself, people who can lead a fight, will be killed. Everyone from government officials and policemen to teachers and religious leaders will be killed. And then they will start reshaping your society. Women will be isolated, trapped inside their homes. Men will be expected to convert or remain as second-class citizens for the rest of their lives. And many of them will convert. Give the theocrats 50 years, he concluded, and your society will have been completely reshaped in their image, and there will be no one left who recalls what life was like before they arrived.
They'd have to land a huge army, Jess pointed out. Could they afford it when they're fighting the Commonwealth at the same time?
They'd be able to call in planetary bombardment strikes if you got uppity, Patrick said. I don't think they would operate under restrictive ROE, rules of engagement.
I see, Jess said. There was no trace of emotion in her voice. And what can you offer us that makes concealing you from them, she jerked a finger upwards indicating the sky, worth the risk?
We can help you fight, Davidson said.
because I bet you anything you care to put forward that the theocracy will have worn out its welcome within 3 weeks.
I'd not take that bet, Jess said.
She rose.
You will be allowed to stay here for the moment, Patrick, as long as you don't cause trouble or attract attention. Do not attempt to contact the PDC or any other remnants of the occupation force.
Understood, Davidson said.
There are other stragglers, Jess continued. We may try and hide them, depending on what happens. But some of them won't be taken alive. Too many collaborators have already been killed in the fighting. It's hard to keep people back from murdering them all.
Patrick heard the unspoken threat in her voice and nodded. Jess paused and then met his eyes.
If the theocracy starts trying to control us, you can help us fight, she added slowly. We will need your help if things become as bad as you suggest they will. But if they leave us alone, we will leave them alone.
They won't, Davidson predicted.
We will see, Jess said. And one other thing.
Patrick looked at her earnest eyes and nodded. Keep your men under tight control, Jess said. Her voice was very firm. I had to argue for hours to convince some people not to go after you at once. Some of them wanted revenge. Others just wanted to eliminate you before you became a threat. I had to argue with men who don't always trust my judgment.
She took a breath. Please don't make me regret that, Patrick.
I won't, Davidson said. He hesitated, and then asked the question that had been nagging at him since he'd realized she was a girl. Why did you join the insurgency anyway?
Jess smiled at him.
Isn't it obvious? She asked.
I wanted my planet to be free.
Davidson sighed. I'm sorry, for what it's worth, he said. But the same factors that made you so interesting to the Commonwealth will attract the theocracy. He was tempted to ask what kind of life she would have had if the Commonwealth had never invaded and the theocracy had never existed. Would she have reached a position of considerable power and influence anyway, or would her gender have restricted her? Would she have been allowed to choose her own husband, or would her family have picked a man for her? He didn't dare disrupt their fragile agreement by asking.
If we win the war, there shouldn't be any need to hold Cadiz against its will, he said instead. And I believe the occupation will not be restored.
Jess met his eyes.
And if you lose?
Davidson snorted.
I think we'll have worse problems to worry about, he said. The theocracy will not leave people like me alive.
Chapter 33. There had never been a terrorist attack in Tyre City. Not one. The planet's original population had been volunteers, instead of the reluctant exiles shipped to worlds that didn't need or want them, and anyone who wanted to opt out of the corporate-based society could have done so easily. Even the handful of insurgencies the newborn Commonwealth had faced had never reached Tyre City. The locale had always known peace.
Until now, Duke Lucas thought, as his air car flew towards the royal palace. Smoke rose from a dozen locations all over the city, while armed air cars and military hovercraft circled, looking for targets. Beside him, Sandra, his personal assistant, looked faintly uneasy.
No one will ever feel safe again.
He glared down at his terminal, half wishing he could just push everything that had happened out of his mind. The attacks had seemed to come out of nowhere, starting with computer viruses striking various planetary data nets and ending with outright attacks on the political and military infrastructure. No one had expected such an assault, despite the looming threat of war, and planetary security forces had been caught flat-footed. There had already been a string of incidents caused by nervous guardsmen that had resulted in fatal shootings.
"Your Grace," Sandra said. I have the latest report from Pinnacle.
Go ahead, Lucas ordered.
Sandra was a formidably efficient woman with East Asian features and a mind like a steel trap. He happened to know she'd pushed augmentation as far as it could go, at least for civilians. Half of her mind was permanently connected to the data net.
What's the bad news?
A freighter was intercepted by the security patrols before it could break into the facility using old IFF codes, Sandra said. The crew detonated the self-destruct before they could be taken into custody.
Well, thank goodness for paranoia, Lucas said.
The access codes had been changed only a week prior, following the reports from the border. There had been protests at the time, but he had a feeling they would be muted now.
Do we have any incident reports from the cloud scoops?
Not as yet, Sandra said. They're still running around like headless chickens. Lucas nodded unsurprised. They'd called enough security drills over the past few weeks to leave his security teams confident they could handle anything. Evidently, they'd been wrong. Or at least too blasé about the alert when it began. And then the shit had hit the fan. He had a feeling, when reports started to come in from the rest of the Commonwealth, that there would be more attacks. The theocracy clearly didn't believe in doing things by halves.
But they have to make damn sure they win now, he thought, as he looked at one of the plumes of smoke. They've made us mad.
He looked back at Sandra.
Is there any word from the Admiralty?
No, sir, Sandra said. They've gone into lockdown.
Just like the rest of the planet,
Lucas thought. Normally there would be hundreds of air cars over the city and thousands of automobiles moving through the streets. Now it was eerily quiet, the only signs of life being armed soldiers as they hurried to reinforce the guards at potential targets.
I wouldn't even be here if the king hadn't called me personally.
He sucked in a breath as the air car dropped down and landed neatly in front of the palace. It was easy to see the Royal Marines, in full combat battle dress, pointing weapons at his vehicle as the hatch opened. One moment of panic, the morbid side of his mind noted, and his career would come to a short, sharp end. Then the family council would have to select his successor while the war started to rage. He stepped out of the car and submitted without an argument to the scanners the Marines waved over his body. Behind him, Sandra was getting the same treatment, only more thoroughly. She rarely visited the palace. Inside there were armed guards everywhere, looking round as if they expected the portraits on the walls to spring to life and attack. Lucas tried not to think about new dangers as they were hurried through the corridors and up the stairs into the formal audience chamber. The king was already there, standing in front of the window and staring out over the city, his entire body tense. He'd warned of the theocracy's threat as soon as he'd become old enough to take an interest in politics, Lucas knew. Now, his worst fears had come to pass.
Your Majesty, Sandra said.
It was the first time she'd ever spoken before her master.
Should you be standing there?
The king turned to face her, his dark eyes glittering. If they have a sniper with a weapon that can break through that window, he said, I'm dead anyway. I just had to see for myself.
Sandra dropped to one knee. I'm sorry, Your Majesty, she said.
Think nothing of it, the king said. He looked at Lucas. Thank you for coming. Lucas's lips twitched.
Your message didn't suggest I had a choice, Your Majesty, he said flatly. Why did you call me here?
The war has begun, the king said. We have reports from a dozen systems, each one reporting terrorist attacks on political, military, and economic targets. In some places the damage has been quite extensive, in others, the terrorists were intercepted before they could do any real harm. These are the first shots in the war.
Yes, Your Majesty, Lucas said. He took a breath. His daughter was on the front lines.
Has there been any word from Cadiz?
Contact was lost 3 hours ago, the king said. I am assuming the worst. He met Lucas's eyes.
The theocracy's ambassador has requested permission to meet with me, he added. I do not expect it to be a very pleasant meeting. There will probably be a declaration of war involved. Even if there isn't, Parliament is meeting in emergency session this afternoon. I have no doubt that a declaration of war will pass through both houses within an hour.
Yes, Your Majesty, Lucas said.
You will attend the meeting, the king said. Your insights will be welcome. But there is another reason I called you here. In a state of war, the normal checks and balances on political power are removed. I will wield supreme power over the state.